I'd like to add my welcome to Aaron's and thank you all for being here. As Aaron said, we're extremely happy to have Gayatri with us. We will talk a little bit about the film, about Fanon for, I don't know, half an hour or so, and then we'll open it up and the rest of the time will be yours. But we just wanted to get something started. Well, I thought that one of the things I would do is begin with a question about the film we've just watched and, mm-hmm. and about its relation to the book on which it's based, mm-hmm. Which it, in one sense, illustrates cinematically and then also interprets partly in relation to the present and not simply in relation to the struggles it depicts. So I'm wondering if you can perhaps say a few words about the different, let's say, temporalities in which we approach these two objects, the film and the book. And partly what I mean here is that the time we might spend engaging them is different in some way. When we're reading, we can reread a passage, we can pause over a detail, we can look something up and then return to where we were. But when we're watching a film, this seems to be a bit more difficult as a practice, you know, so that this is a question of the time we need to read something, the speed with which we can register and think about something. And this is something that arose for the filmmakers themselves mm-hmm. in the voiceover, right, which is spoken by Lauryn Hill. From what they say, they tell this little story at the beginning of the book version that Lauryn recorded the approximately 40 minutes of text soon after being released from prison. And she read it for them too quickly at the beginning. They felt that the narrative had to be slowed down in some way. And she at first defended the speed with which she read it by claiming that Fanon's book had actually helped her liberate herself from 400 years of oppression and slavery when she read it. And so that in some way she felt that it had to be read with a kind of upbeat tempo because this was something that had made her very happy. And she said it's like when Charlie Parker and John Coltrane discover the African roots in jazz and create bebop, which was also something that had an upbeat tempo. So the filmmakers say that they kind of understood what she said, but they still wanted her to read it more slowly. And so that they wanted the viewers to follow things in the way almost that you would read a book, or it was important for them to at least close the gap between the different speeds which you do that. And so I guess I'm just interested in hearing what you might say about this and what you might say about the speed with which you might prefer to approach anything you read. And this is perhaps a question about the extent to which a book can be translated into a film, and also a question about how we can best engage anything that we encounter.
You know, I don't really know much about film. I don't even watch much film, see what I mean? So
Gayatri and I once saw AI together.
So therefore, I mean, as you say, they say it themselves on page 8 mm-hmm. of this book that the way in which people read, mindful that audiences are immersed in the pace and rhythm of a film mm-hmm. while viewing it, which differs greatly from the experience of readers moving through a book at their own pace. We worked throughout the editing process to present the text as dynamically as possible. Mm-hmm. I don't really know what the word dynamically means there. Mm-hmm. So I would rather ask, I mean, it's also very interesting to me that they describe Fanon's book as a non-fiction book.
Yeah.
I think that's an unfortunate description of Fanon's book. It's all right, don't worry about it. But so that would be my comment, because I'm not really capable of answering the question that you're asking.
Ah,
it seems to me, you know, but I would like to say one thing, all right, and then you can ask your question.
Yeah.
You know, when they interview Tonderai Makoni, uh-huh. mm-hmm. and they say, I heard a rough knock on the door, he says, I say, who is there? And they shout, police. So I dressed up and went with police to police cells. They told my wife that I'll be back in a short period of time. How long were you in prison? I was in prison approximately for 5 years. Mm-hmm. I would just like to say, it has nothing to do with questions of form and so on, mm-hmm. that like the anthropologists in Chicago, Jean Komaroff.
Komaroff,
like the Komaroffs. I was, after all, you know, for me, colonialism is not like a story. I was born in British India, mm-hmm. so that to an extent I'm more cynical about, gung-ho. Mm-hmm. So I would say that both the Komaroffs and I feel that if one begins, I think the film is great.
Yeah,
that's a different film. Thing.
Yeah.
If one's going to take it as a teaching text, if we feel that the world's disasters begin with the play of colony and capital, mm-hmm. we forget that colonialism is a short period of history. History is long. Mm-hmm. And so I would like to say that after independence, what happens is something that Fanon very much writes about with an extraordinary brilliance and intelligence.
Yeah, yeah.
And I would therefore like to say that there's a great deal of violence in the so-called post-colonial nations. One of my two supervisors, 7 years of schooling, Ujjal Lohar is his name, a very idealistic man, mm-hmm. born in the illiterate landless community, mm-hmm. and genuinely brilliantly intelligent. I've worked with him for 10 years. Just before the elections, he has just been trumped, like this guy, and remember, no colonials there. Mm-hmm. He has just been arrested on trumped-up charges by the party in power because he refused to renege and say, I do not belong to the left party. This is the bottom layer of the world's largest democracy, post-colonial nation, fantastic independence. So they have taken him, they have given him non-bailable charges of attempted murder, mm-hmm. and molestation, mm-hmm. sexual harassment. And he is, in fact, in fear, in hiding, but still working. Mm-hmm. So, and I'm talking to people all the time. So, therefore, the idea that colonialism is what kills us alone is, I think, in the contemporary context, something that we have to think about. It's not that Fanon liberates me. Fanon is my brother. Fanon doesn't liberate me from the history of the world.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's, I would just like to say this in the name of this young man who is in great danger right now. Mm-hmm. So I would like to mm-hmm. dedicate my remarks, as mm-hmm. it were, in the hope mm-hmm. that somehow, I can't even send money because Modi has not made it impossible for money being mm-hmm. sent from the United States mm-hmm. as anything but donation.
Yeah.
So mm-hmm. therefore, it's. I just wanted to get that said. You know, it's page 40, exactly what he's describing.
Yeah.
But it hasn't been done by white people, by ourselves. So we have to remember this as we go into this discussion.
Yeah. I mean, I think that one of the reasons that I opened up with the question was just because you're such a slow and patient reader, and also. Because I remember even once in a discussion at Columbia, you even argued for pre-digital modes of reading, digital forms of production, you know, that one needed to have not just, let's say, a slow food movement, but a slow reading movement. And so it was interesting to see how this becomes thematized within the directors, that they actually insist on people moving more slowly, which I think is also something that when you read the Fanon, as you say, He's very good on talking about the survival of violence after colonization, right? And in fact, whether or not colonization ever ends is a question.
Mm.
So this is one. I mean, this is actually linked to the next thing I was maybe hoping you could say something about is about the difficult ambivalences that attend the appearance of issues of identity and self-determination that are at the heart of both colonization and decolonization, because in both instances, identity and identification are neither, let's say, historically universal concepts nor politically innocent ones. And especially when the colonizer would seem to subject the colonial other to a double command. I mean, this comes up in the film when they're saying that every colonial subject wants to have a house, wants to, you know, all the things that they want. So it's almost like, be like me, but don't be like me. Be mimetically identical, but be totally different. And so that the colonial subject seems to be situated between difference and similitude, at almost the, let's say, the vanishing point of some kind of subjectivity. And I was thinking about his interest in psychoanalysis, of course, because psychoanalysis' own interest in the problem identification provides him with a vocabulary and a framework in which to, let's say, diagnose and treat not only psychological disorders produced in individuals by the violence of colonialism, but also the, let's say, the neurotic structure of colonialism itself. I mean, this is one of the things that he seems to be talking about. And so in Black Skin, Black Mass, you remember, he seems to suggest that this distinction actually dissolves in some way, because he says that the Negro is not any more than the white man. So that both of them are implicated, not only in the violence, but also in the harm that is caused to everyone. So this is just a question about the complicated place of identity within colonial and decolonial struggles, and perhaps to speak to the way in which the rhetoric of identity and self-determination often goes hand in hand, not only with the colonial project, but also with violence in general.
This is an excellent question, and the problem with this is, of course, the phrase "the colonial subject."
Yes,
I mean, you know, who the hell is the colonial subject? Yeah. See, remember that if you look at The Wretched of the Earth carefully, you will see that all those sentences about peasants knowing that they have to, in The Wretched of the Earth. What Fanon actually writes in great detail, first of all, that the anti-colonial struggle of the peasant suffering greatly is not nationalist to start with.
Yeah.
That they have, and this is so true for anyone who works with the bottom layer of any country, that the nation is not something that they are really thinking about. So
it's
that when
survival.
The nationalism, it's not even the nationalism then is made into a kind of Orientalist notion, which is fed to these cannon fodder people. You know, the country is not just these people. That's something, who is the colonial subject is a question that has to be asked. And what we have to realize is that it played out differently in the Caribbean. You know, it's so, Fanon is someone who comes from the Caribbean into this place. Why does he go to Algeria? Because he's in Brittany, remember that. And he's working with French analysts who are, they're not really analysts, they're more psychiatrists, who are working very carefully on developing psychiatry into acknowledging that colonialism is a source of extraordinary psychological violence. They're working together, and suddenly Fanon is transferred to Algeria. He's not happy. He's not happy. So because his work, which was with these people, suddenly has disappeared. But then slowly he begins to see that he can be helpful here, but he does not move with the FLN, because he feels that he cannot be helpful if he moves with the FLN. So, I mean, to take him as describing, I mean, those are extremely rousing sentences from The Wretched of the Earth, but they are not, I mean, they ignore a lot of the stuff that's inside there. So, and then he says about the peasants, as you remember, that they cannot really, because of their belief in magic and so on and so forth, they cannot really be developed into an anti-colonial force, and therefore the anti-colonialism moves away from the countryside. So, I mean, this is a guy who's trying to look at a very specific kind of colonialism. We have to remember Heart of Darkness, where Conrad distinguishes between British imperialism and Dutch and Belgian, the Belgian Free State, which owns the Congo and so on. And we have to think about Lumumba. And it seems to me that we can't really just, as a person who was, in fact, who remembers being in, I mean, it's not for me a romantic thing from which I'm liberated. Mm-hmm. We did not liberate ourselves. Yeah. There was a kind of Orientalist negotiation, and then with Clifford Attlee's government, and then the day that we were independent, decolonization began to go wrong. Mm-hmm. And that happened in Algeria as well, and Fanon predicted it. Yeah. We have to see that. So
he insists on that, actually.
Oh, he, absolutely.
He does, yes.
And do you remember what he says? I mean, I'm not going to talk more, so I'm going to ask you a question. Do you remember what he says would be the solution?
To the cycle?
To having a post-colonial world with some social justice in it?
No.
You don't remember? No. Yes. The education of young people into and going away from leaders and the education of young people into, you see, both Gramsci and Fanon had this thing, is liberal education something that can only produce oligarchies? Mm-hmm. No. That's the big, in fact, I would say yes, having been a teacher for so long.
Yes.
But they had these, Fanon very young, 36, and Gramsci in jail.
Yeah.
Both of Gramsci deformed, a hunchback in jail.
Yeah.
They both had the feeling that they could use real education, not just vocational, income production, etc., to change countries.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's the solution given in The Wretched of the Earth. Not a word about that.
I mean,
I just want to say one thing. Okay, I'm going to read from Fanon. Okay, so I was just in Paris speaking for Marie Condé, right? And what did we see? Well, no, I'm not going to go there. Okay, so I say, Fanon, today the most peculiar African-American expression of the kind of identity politics where one forgets class is Afro-pessimism. It just forgets Africa. So Fanon gives an ungendered version of this problematic when it was just about to take shape, he writes. It can be affirmed that in the West Indies, now this is the Caribbean model, in the West Indies in 1939, no spontaneous claim of negritude rang forth.
Yeah.
And in fact, that's another thing about black skin, white masks, as I say in my introduction, that Mama Sia Negro, he leaves that behind.
Yeah.
And the English translation doesn't say that that chapter is called the lived experience. And then he moves to Hegel. It's a, that's
at
what,
the end, it, yes,
at the
yes,
end.
Yeah.
This is in the middle. So anyway, it can be affirmed that in the, so it was then that three events occurred successively, he writes. The first event was the arrival of Césaire. Césaire, who comes French educated into, for the first time, a lycée teacher, a man, therefore, who was apparently worthy of respect, was seen to announce quite simply to West Indian society that it is fine and good to be a Negro. To be sure, this created a scandal. It was said at the time that he was a little mad. And his colleagues went out of their way in Martinique to give details as to his supposed ailment. What indeed could be more grotesque than an educated man, a man with a diploma, here it's the colonial subject, having in consequence understood a good many things, among others that it was unfortunate to be a Negro, proclaiming that his skin was beautiful and that the big black hole was a source of truth. And Condé's book, first book, Erima Konon, gave us a reversal, perhaps a clean amen, an amazing prefiguration of what has become a global problem today. This, see, these things change.
Yeah.
So, with constructive sympathy, for all medicine turns to poison unless the changing dosage determination is caught constantly. That's the education. So you can't look at this thing and say, oh, my goodness, it liberated me.
No.
You know, especially upper-class diaspora.
Yeah.
No. You know, it, you can't say that. So,
but you say that there is a, I mean, there's some mechanism that can enable something to happen, and that can allow for the possibility of a future that won't simply be the repetition of the past, which would be through this process of education.
Or an invocation of the past.
But not just any education, because some forms of education are entirely compatible with colonialism. This week I was just teaching, I'm doing a course on Emerson and Douglas, so I was just teaching Douglas's 1845 narrative. And of course, there's the sort of amazing moment when Douglas describes moving from the plantation to Baltimore. And at that moment, he has a mistress who's never had a slave before, so she's entirely illiterate on how to behave with him. So she sits down to teach him the ABCs. The master comes in, goes into a rage when he sees her teaching him the ABCs and says, "You can't teach a nigger how to read. If you teach a nigger how to read, he won't be a nigger anymore." And the little Douglas says, "The vehemence which the master so much did not want me to learn how to read made me understand the pathway to my freedom." So it's an amazing text on the empowerment that can come with a certain kind of literacy. And within the film, of course, the women are saying that one of the ways in which they're kept down is by preventing them from becoming literate.
But then what the question is what is the quality of the education?
Yes.
What is the quality of the... Nobody bothers. I mean, you have these photographs of people actually sitting down and reading books. But, you know, when we think about our own... When we think about... When we think... It's my niece from California who's going through a very, very ugly divorce. So I talk to her, talk to her every day. And it's an Indian screwing an Indian, right? She will know. So at any rate, what was I talking about before she called? Sorry.
Education.
Yes. So therefore, you know, nobody bothers about that.
Yeah.
You know, when I'm also very cynical about education.
Yeah.
You know, okay, so they sit down. But really, in order to open your heads,
yeah.
You see, I don't think, I mean, all these insane, I mean, it's very good to be literate. To have literacy, but in just literacy?
No, it has nothing. To be a particular kind of
literacy. Literacy, yeah. Numeracy, nothing. No, yeah. They're not particular kind of literacy. Yeah. Literacy is an instrument. Mm-hmm. You know, literacy is an instrument.
Yeah.
And sometimes, although I don't want people to be illiterate, in my 40 years of teaching among the landless illiterate, the very smart illiterate ones, because they haven't been ruined by bad education, in fact, I don't want people to be illiterate, don't get me wrong. But because the quality of education down there, you see, you can so easily use this. Now we are going to school. But what are you learning?
Nothing.
Because nobody knows how to teach there. Yeah. So when Fanon writes, the greatest task is to understand at all moments what is happening with us. We must not cultivate the exceptional. No leadership, role model, ancestor worship. Look for heroes, another form of the leader. He's absolutely correct. Yeah. We must lift the people, expand the brain of the people, opening their heads. It's almost impossible. How do I know this? Because of the caste system, which is much longer than colonialism. Colonialism, 300-400 years. We have destroyed, I'm a caste Hindu, we have destroyed our own people for thousands of years. And when such historical crimes are committed, and believe me, there are crimes before colonialism, it's an easy thing to point fingers like this. And so I'm not saying colonialism is good, it's an awful thing. But I'm just saying that it should not become a thing of we can do this and that.
Yeah.
But so therefore, when I sit with them, what I have to say is, because you can't teach intellectual labor.
Yeah.
When you destroy heads like that, you know, you really have to say that perhaps something will happen by chance.
Yeah.
It's not, so this, Fanon knows absolutely what he's talking about when he says expand the brain of the people, differentiate it, make it human.
Yeah.
Make it human. To be responsible in an underdeveloped country is to know that everything depends definitively on the elevation of thought that Du Bois will call communicating with the stars, not just income production. of what one calls too quickly politicization. Mm-hmm. This is Fanon in the same book.
Yeah, yeah.
So therefore, you know, it just seems to me that it's literacy and numeracy by itself, mm-hmm. I mean, although it is necessary, mm-hmm. it's nothing.
Not enough. Yeah.
Because it's an instrument. Mm-hmm. You leave, what happens today in the largest sectors of the electorate in the tricontinental space, mm-hmm. because we don't use that phrase third world anymore. Mm-hmm. So in that tricontinental space, the largest sectors of the electorate are kept ignorant.
Yeah.
And this is why this guy, my supervisor, is going to be sent to prison on non-bailable offenses.
Yeah. Yeah.
You don't want anybody in that group, like your Frederick Douglass's mistress, to think, to have their head suddenly thinking. So that's a much bigger problem than just they didn't let us go to school and we are getting education.
Right.
That's where we begin.
Also, what I like about what you're saying is that it also invites us to expand the concept of literacy, because one of the things that happens in the Douglass narrative is that he already is extremely literate in reading social situations. You know, even before he learns how to read a book or to read text, he's very good. He knows that poor white children are at the same time competitive. So he will say, I can write better than you. No, you can't. Yes, I can. No, you can't. Yes, I can. Show me. And I got a lot of free lessons that way. You know, so it's a way in which it's true that the book plays with the concept of literacy, and it doesn't reduce it just to reading books.
And you know, Frederick Douglass is an unbelievably brilliant man.
He's amazing.
Unbelievably brilliant man. I mean, when he discusses the business about federal and states, it's applicable today.
Yeah.
So therefore, you can't take a Fanon and a Frederick Douglass and a Gramsci and make your world.
Yeah.
We are ordinary people.
Yeah.
We are not, we can't ancestor worship them.
Yeah.
They become teaching texts.
Exactly.
It's a very different thing from, you know, saying, you know, I found very interesting Olson's little, I love him, I think he's a wonderful guy, but this thing here, whatchamacallit here, when he thanks me, this parenthesis here, you know, that it is true that it was in one take, with both of us were completely mm-hmm. surprised that, hey, it happens in one take. And he says, you know, I'm not a good teacher, but he calls me a great teacher. I don't know how he knows that. But at any rate, he says, and she critiques the film possibly in an accurate way. Hey, boy, you couldn't avoid that.
No.
You couldn't avoid that. That barrier, that, what you call it, it's in that parenthesis that everything hangs. But anyway, so I would say that would be my thing.
Yeah, and actually, this leads to the next question. I just have a couple more, and then we'll open it up. But it leads to the next one, because one of the things that I was thinking about is the way in which we use these texts, let's say from Douglass to Gramsci to Fanon, as resources for doing contemporary political work. Right. One of the things that the filmmakers say in the introduction to the book version is that they started the film, started working on the film in 2012, 2 years before Eric Garner is shot to death by a New York City police officer. And you may remember, and they point this out, that Garner's last, in his last desperate gasp, he said, "I can't breathe." And this was caught on video camera. It's later echoed by protesters in the streets of New York who are carrying posters of Fanon and his statement that we revolt simply because, for many reasons, we can no longer breathe. Right? And so what's remarkable for me, so you're saying that the Douglass seems so contemporary, is that how contemporary Fanon's writings seem at different times in a world in which, whether we're talking about New York, Ferguson, Iraq, Afghanistan, Venezuela, Nicaragua, wherever, and actually with a nod toward the exhibition that's on view here, Israel and Palestine, violence is everywhere, and they seem to, these texts nevertheless seem to speak to us not only about the endless cycles of violence and reciprocal exchanges of violence, which is clear in the film too, but also about the ways in which we might potentially minimize violence. And so I'm wondering about two things here. One is, Fanon's sense of the inescapability of violence, because he seems to insist on this all the time, of the way in which violence is often the only way to combat violence, of the way in which both the violence of colonialism and the violence that endures as colonialism is dying, and as another political formation seeks to constitute or found a new political order, reinforce one another, even if they try to go in different directions. So this suggests that, for me, that Fanon is perhaps one of the greatest analysts of the inevitability of political complicity. And this is part of his usefulness, I think, to us today. And then the second thing is just a procedural matter, and it's linked to what you said a minute ago, about the way in which we so often return to historical texts, in this case to a text that's written almost 60 years ago, The Wretched of the Earth, to discover resources for doing political work in the present. And I think part of this has to do with the way in which any contemporary issue that we may wish to address didn't fall from the sky. It has a history. But I wonder if you could say a few words about the particular usefulness of returning, okay, to Fanon, but also to Gramsci, to Douglas, whoever, today, and perhaps also the usefulness of returning to texts written in other moments and places in order to think about contemporary injustices and violence in general.
Eduardo, I know you want me to give another kind of answer because you know me so well.
I'm inviting you.
I know, exactly. I know. So that's the answer I'll give.
Yes.
Okay? Because I don't, in fact, return to text. You know this very well.
You do all the time.
No, I don't. I'll tell you what happens. What happens is I teach these texts in U.S. classrooms, in, British classrooms, all kinds of very nice elite schools, sometimes not so elite, but nonetheless universities. And for a very long time. And then suddenly, because when I'm actually doing the work, which because I think the only work that perhaps because it is the only work I can do is teaching work, so that you slowly, like as I have said many times, just as without developing your body, it's a bad analogy, all analogies are bad, but it works, without developing your muscles, you wouldn't be able to do anything with your body. In the same way, unless your soul is cooked, you won't be able to do anything with anything. So that one is, that's what I say, slow education. And you find that resonance.
Yeah.
You know, I've been teaching Gramsci since the 60s.
Yeah.
And then, because you take the, when you're working, you take the imperatives about how to work from what you're dealing with.
Yeah.
Not from Antonio Gramsci.
Yeah. Yeah.
Nor from Franz Fanon.
Yeah.
You read them, Fanon and Gramsci and Marx, etc., as if they are creative texts.
Yeah.
You read them as you have learned to read literature, moving into their space. Yeah. See, this is one of the problems. Judith Butler's work, which I very much like, but it doesn't have this particular. Yeah. She was trained in analytic philosophy, which doesn't question these nature of the subject. So she can claim precarity, and she can claim this, and she can claim that. And although she's ready, she's poised for this, but that's, so therefore, our training is not to think of Gramsci and go back, but to suddenly find something, some surprising thing. My God, this is what he was talking about later.
Yeah.
Later. So to that extent, you know, it's finding resonances rather than going back to them in order to do work. I don't think you can do work by following anyone. It has to come from what you're working with. You know what I mean?
I know what you mean. And part of it is just, as you say, the resonance between the text that you're reading and whatever it is that you're trying to think about.
And
on
you
the ground.
Have internalized Marx and Fanon and Gramsci and Hegel and whoever by reading them, by entering their space rather than just accusing them.
Yeah.
And that's why the end of Black Skin, White Masks is so fantastic.
Yeah.
Because Fanon enters master-slave dialectic and he makes the, he's a very smart man, he makes the deliberate mistake of turning it into a narrative,
yeah,
and claims the place,
yeah, yeah,
of the Hegelian subject, not the place of the slave.
Yeah.
So this is something that one needs to look at,
yeah,
rather than just simply go on and on about the very noble sentences,
right,
in,
right,
Wretched of the Earth, written in the last 10 weeks. He was a wild boy who was, yeah, unbelievably, sorry for calling him a boy, but at 77, the age of 36, seems an age where with affection you can call him. So therefore, when he says these things and he's dictating to Josie,
yeah,
it's a very different, yeah, kind of, I mean, these come up.
Yeah.
These sentences,
yeah,
come up.
Yeah.
But really what one needs to look at is where he's being so deliberately analytic.
Yeah.
I think when Olsen showed me the film,
uh-huh,
in Stockholm,
mm-hmm,
I told him that I couldn't do it because it did not seem to me to reflect Fanon. Because,
yeah,
here Edward and I,
yeah,
Saeed and I think the same.
Yeah.
I mean, he was not interested in endorsing violence.
Yes.
He was not interested in saying only violence can cure violence.
Mm-hmm.
He was saying, unfortunately, this is the disease that colonialism,
yeah, yeah,
produces.
Yeah.
All the cases are at the back of the book,
yeah,
in the appendix.
Yeah. Yeah.
He was a healer. So that to an extent there is, you know, there, when there is violence, he understood it as this failing,
mm-hmm,
that can only be healed if colonialism does not act as it acts,
mm-hmm,
during the time,
yeah,
that he was in Algeria.
Yeah.
And so even in Algeria,
yeah,
the upper classes were making different kinds of arrangements,
yeah,
with France, weren't,
yeah,
they? So that's what I would say. We,
yeah,
have to understand him slowly and in his fullness.
I mean, so I was saying that he gives us an opportunity to think about how to minimize violence. But I'm glad that you said what you said about
cure him. Violence.
Yeah.
Not minimize. Cure.
Cure.
Knowing that, of course, it cannot be fully cured.
Yeah.
That's the dangerous supplement.
Yeah.
Because violence can even be desired.
Yeah.
So to an extent,
yeah,
if you read his actual case histories,
yeah,
and so on,
yeah,
you'll see that this is a very complicated point,
yeah,
of view.
Yeah.
I think today, when the kind of unexamined, superficial leftism of people whose names I will not mention, that endorses violence,
yeah,
calling it Maoism and so,
yeah,
on and so forth,
yeah,
I think that's a crime.
Yeah.
I think that's,
yeah,
a crime.
Yeah.
Because these are cannon fodder folks. They don't know anything about Mao.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so it's what on earth is this? I think the endorsement,
yeah,
of violence, which Sartre saw quickly by just reading the first chapter. I mean, when you read Sartre and Simone de Beauvoir talking about, oh, how very nice he looks in his photographs after,
yeah,
his death,
yeah,
because when they had seen him, of course, he was completely decimated.
Yeah.
You realize that it is like the reverse racism that many of us experience today. See, the Global South used to be all bad, now it's all good. So that's how Fanon was for,
yeah,
them.
Yeah.
And he read that first chapter quickly,
yeah,
and forever put a seal on,
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
I gotta say that I gotta support violence.
Yeah.
No, that's,
yeah,
that's,
yeah,
not Fanon.
Yeah. So this will be the last one, and then we'll open it up. It takes its point of departure at some point from your saying that Fanon also has to be read in a literary way. Everyone, yes.
But that's because that's how I'm trained.
Exactly.
Not everyone has to read that way. But our usefulness is that we can produce that one.
Okay, I will say that everyone should read this way.
Well, that's
okay.
You.
So, but I'm wondering if maybe you and we together could just improvise a little bit about Fanon's early interest in literature and its possible survival in his later works. So this is part of because his interest in the theater developed while he was in medical school between 46 and 51. He writes two plays in 49,
mm-hmm,
one called the Drowning Eye, The Parallel Hands. He's reading Césaire. He, in 53, says he's going to write a book on Richard Wright's novels. He's reading Racine, he's reading Corneille. He's doing a lot with literature at the same time that he's training. And, I mean, he's reading Aeschylus. And so that he, in the plays, which I think it's also interesting, the plays both have titles that refer to bodily parts.
Yes,
or something. I think this is important. But the plays are concerned with issues of identity and transformation and revolution, although not always in every instance in a political sense, and in particular with the transformative power of words and language. I mean, he's really interested in that. And so I think that a lot of attention has been given to his psychiatric training and its relation to, as you say, the analysis of violence and so on, its effects on psyches and bodies. But can we, I mean, think about the way in which, even when it's not called literature directly, let's say, Fanon has recourse to literature throughout his life as a resource for doing the kind of work and writing that
yes.
he does. And I should add that among all the texts that he read, because he's a voracious reader, he read, as you said, Marx, Engels, Lenin, all of whom also have recourse to literature when they analyze political
yes,
formations.
Yes, Marx is not so hot on literature, I must say.
Marx is extremely hot on
well,
literature.
That's all right. That's another discussion. But
we'll have it tonight.
Okay, good. But the thing is, but people who do, mind healing,
yeah.
they inevitably go towards the literary.
Yeah, yeah.
Because, you know, I mean, Freud, of course, put it wonderfully
yeah.
that, you know, you can get the experience of the impossible in the literary
yeah,
that you
yeah,
can't
yeah.
get with analysis.
Yeah.
So that's a, yes, so absolutely, I'm not surprised by
yeah, yeah.
Fanon's. But one thing, Fanon's notion of identity
mm-hmm.
also was itself, very well nuanced, because he was not Algerian,
yeah.
although he claimed
right.
Algerian citizenship
yeah.
and so on and so forth. He was a black man.
Mm-hmm.
Remember what he said in 1944, I think it was,
mm-hmm.
he was fighting for the Free French. He was fighting
mm-hmm.
for De Gaulle,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
When he first went to
yeah.
Algeria.
Yeah.
He says, the white folks hate the Jews. The Jews hate the Arabs, he writes home.
Mm-hmm.
The Arabs hate the niggers, and I'm a nigger, so I can't establish any connections with
yeah.
anyone.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
That's where he begins. He's
yeah.
19 years old.
Yeah.
It's 1944.
Yeah.
He's for the first time
yeah.
in Algeria.
Yeah.
So to an extent, from there,
yeah.
he then becomes what he becomes.
Yeah.
And he does all the Mujahid work in Tunis.
Yeah.
Remember?
Yeah.
So therefore,
yeah.
Fanon's identity politics is constructed
yeah.
rather than real.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
It's he's a like most of these characters, he's a deeply phenomenological point of view. Loved Hegel.
Yeah.
That's why he says the white man is not, and the
yeah.
black man is
yeah.
not.
Yeah.
Like Marx says,
yeah.
capital is not,
yeah.
and labor is not.
Yeah.
These are forms of appearance.
Yeah. Yeah.
Erscheinungsformen.
Yeah.
So one has to understand him that
yeah.
way.
Yeah. So I'll just close with just a little gift to you about Marx and literature, and then we'll open it up. Because he's 18, not 19, he writes a letter to his father, and he, you know the letter.
Well, listen, Marx is one of my things, but carry
yeah,
on.
Yeah, okay. He writes a letter when he's 18 to his father, and he says that he's arrived at a turning point in his life, and at such moments in one's life, one becomes lyrical, he says. And all of these moments are, on the one hand, a swan song and the beginning of a new poem. And so the turning point that he's arrived at is that he's going to stop writing poems, novels, the things that he's doing, and let them go and start studying law, philosophy, economics. So it's the moment when Marx becomes Marx. And in the middle of the letter, he says, a curtain fell. And then the new Marx takes the stage. And he says, but I still want to erect a memorial in honor of my love for literature.
No.
And my argument is that the memorial is the rest of his corpus.
No, Marx is in fact much more wonderful with poetry
yeah.
and stuff than I was thinking about Satie and stuff like that.
Ah,
you know.
Okay, okay.
When wonderful is the only description
yeah.
of the content of the proletarian revolution, because
yeah.
everything else is form,
yeah.
value form, right?
Yeah.
But the only, everything, in fact, he says, in halt los,
yeah.
but the only description of the content of the revolution of the 19th
yeah.
century,
poetry
of the future.
Poetry of the future. Yeah.
Yeah. And he's serious about
yeah,
that.
He is
not poetry as a method so that you don't, like, create, look towards the past and create the 18 Brumaire.
Yeah.
And in that particular piece, the only thing where, I mean, just think about it. This is the last thing I will say also. You think about it. Marx was born in 1818. Bourgeois Revolution took place in 1789. Not that much, that long ago. Huh? I mean, so like Vietnam War for, Vietnam War, I was alive.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, second, you know what I'm talking about. First, Treaty of Versailles for me, let's say. So it took place,
Yeah.
And so then in 1850, it went wrong.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
He saw 1848, it failed.
Yeah.
1850, it went wrong.
Yeah.
Not yet 1871.
Yeah.
In 1857, he makes an analysis of the revolution that failed.
Yeah.
And so what he's saying there is, and his main criticism is, that the people are not educated, right? They cannot represent themselves.
Yeah.
They must be represented.
Yeah.
That's how Louis Napoleon wins.
Yeah.
And his main criticism is, do not look to the past and say, this is the Brumaire.
Yeah.
Okay? Work for, the content will be the poetry of the future.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that one has drama, tragedy.
Yeah.
First time is tragedy.
Yeah.
Second time is farce.
Yeah. Yeah.
It has dance.
Yeah.
He changes Aesop's Hixalta to Tanzehir.
Yeah.
Right? He changes the jump to dance.
Yeah.
And so, to an extent, there is indeed the literary, yes, this one, this book, this piece, where the only piece where the content of the proletarian revolution is described, people should read it much more carefully and not dismiss all of this as, and remember, the revolutionary form is learning a foreign language so well that your mother tongue will not even come forth when you're using so absolutely against identity and poetry of the future.
Yeah.
This is a marvelous, marvelous piece. So I will speak for the literary in Marx.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
So now that we have agreed,
we open it up.
I'm curious about your thoughts about the moment in the film when Lauryn Hill reads the part about the relationship between human dignity, the idea of human dignity, and the Western subject. And she reads it in a moment, I think right after she talks about land, like the natives' relationship with the land. Do you remember that part?
Mm-hmm. You start.
So my question is,
for you.
My question is, I mean, if I sort of had a hard time wrapping my mind around that, but my instinct is that what she's doing is sort of pointing out the idea that the very idea of human dignity is a Western construct that is not what is being sought in the anti-colonial struggle. But also, it made me think about current struggles for land, how now the anti-neo-colonial struggle has been one against extractivism, both extractivism of land and neo-extractivism.
Mm-hmm.
And in light of that, how do we read both the film and Fanon? Like, where does the dialogue happen, I guess, is my question.
Mm-hmm.
You want to start?
I mean, I just have a reference, and it's actually less related to the film, but because I'm thinking about what you said in another context at the moment. I just went during the spring break to the Utah desert with the photographer Fazl Sheikh and 11 students. It's linked to a project on the ruination of the Utah landscape by uranium mining, oil and gas drilling, and the consequences of that ruination on Native communities. So we were going there, we were visiting the landscape, but also meeting with tribal leaders from the Navajo community in particular. And of course, they are talking about their attachment to the land. They are talking about the need to protect the land, and especially, I mean, the Bears Ears area was very near where we were as well. In the film, it's not, I think if I heard you right, you're wondering if the film is actually stating that what the women want is in fact land, then maybe you're thinking that association between the possessing of land and human dignity, that would be a Western imposition. This is what you're saying, But maybe you want to jump in.
Yes, I will jump in. I think that the human dignity, I think you put your finger on it. You see, I don't think there is a West, by the way. Is Australia the West? What part of Australia is the West? And today, given the fact that the development, for example, of local capitalism in India was suppressed by the colonial folks. So, you know, the Birlas, the big financial, one of my students who is a Birla herself, who you asked the question, right? Okay. So she has written a book at my instigation. She teaches in Toronto now, called Stages of Capital, which is about her family, the Birlas, the great financiers. I mean, before independence, her great-grandfather was, great-granduncle was the sixth richest man in the world, Indian, before independence. So therefore, it's hard for me to just have this monolithic capital W West. I think, I don't know what the West is, frankly. So I would say that human dignity is an English phrase. This I will say, I think languages exist. And there is a wealth of languages in the world, a wealth of languages. So and therefore, what if we really want to think about what kind of concept is it, then we have to at least try to find not just a synonym, but an equivalent concept, in an equivalent thought, in a completely non-Latin language. So therefore, I don't really even think about those kinds of things. I give many lectures in Bengali, so I can very easily find a very nice elite Bengali translation of the words human dignity. But when I'm in my villages with those extremely poor folks speaking regional language, that phrase in Bengali, there's the problem with the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, all translated into extremely elite stuff, so elite level of language. So therefore, it doesn't make any sense that whatever the hell Bengali phrase I might concoct, it would make no sense, and I don't work in terms of that. So yes, I would say that the idea, and you know, I was on the ethics committee of the World Economic Forum. All these crooks were constantly talking about restoring human dignity to people. I don't know what that would mean. But land, yes, you don't have to really say that it's different. Land is land, you know what I mean? On the other hand, land is also not land. Mm-hmm. Because, again, it's the wonderful chapter in Capital One called the sogenannte primitive, so-called primitive accumulation, where Marx is telling us very carefully that the first primitive accumulation happens as land is turned into agribusiness. Mm-hmm. That's the first primitive accumulation. And a lot of that is happening, for example, in the areas where I work. And how is it happening? The Bangladeshi diasporics from Germany, they're Germans, are bringing in European Union with all those stars into the area and turning land farming into agribusiness. Okay, so therefore, and of course it's looking good, right? More money, more this and that, but it's the insertion of land into capital. And Marx in that chapter mocks people who think land is real, quotes Cicero, and mocks people saying yes. So because it is once again, it's form of appearance as the first capital. So to an extent, and Marx after all could not know, although wonderful work has been done by people like Jim O'Connor and others, on thinking environmentalism from the left, wonderful work, but Marx himself was not thinking of it. He was still within town and country, right? So therefore, it seems to me that we can take that lesson. And the idea that the only way in which we will save ourselves is, and I'll use affect words rather than theoretical words, is by restraining greed, which is natural. That's where education comes in. The interest in social justice has to restrain greed. So therefore, that particular lesson can be applied to what is primitive accumulation, which is your... So when we think about, and I'm now speaking from the experience of 40 years of working with so-called tribals and untouchables and so on. And so I use those words because that phenomenon still exists. So therefore, we should not mistake, although it's a good thing mm-hmm. to build on, we should not mistake cultural conformity of the Aboriginal in his or her place rather than, we should not mistake that for environmentalism. I'm not insulting anyone. I'm just mm-hmm. saying we are like them and they are like us. Yeah. Yeah. So therefore, one doesn't, that is also a kind of, you know, reverse racism, which is not useful.
Yeah.
Then there would be no casinos. The idea of working together for an education, which will bring in again and again, generation by generation, permanent, this is if you like, I don't like to use that word, but permanent revolution. Because every generation is born greedy. That's the Anthropocene begins with becoming human, not with capitalism. So that therefore, I mean, this is very mm-hmm. anti-humanist mm-hmm. what I'm saying, I don't mind. So therefore, I think education dehumanizes. Mm-hmm. So therefore, this idea of treating the primitive accumulation with restraint, that's where we mm-hmm. will really begin to find environmentalism that will perhaps do something for us. But that only comes through developing a will for social justice. And if I can mm-hmm. be just one mm-hmm. more sentence, a little psychoanalytic. See, what I feel is that, you know, computer programming, I have said, is an empirical thing, which is like what Freud called the meta-psychological. Mm-hmm. That is to say, the production of psychology through non-psychological methods, which is mm-hmm. not accessible mm-hmm. to psychology. Mm-hmm. And the those of you who are somewhat into Lacan, you will think about the point capitant, where that meta-psychological kind of touches mm-hmm. the analyst, if the analyst is doing something careful. And my feeling is, although this is not psychoanalytic, that it is, however rude it may seem, the kind of teaching that I'm talking about, it's a very fearful task, is to go into that metapsychological, the programming part of the human mind, and drag it into something completely crude, as mm-hmm. crude as a will. What mm-hmm. can be more crude than a will? Mm-hmm. A will for social justice. It's the hardest description of the kind of teaching that I'm talking about. That is our task. I don't think everybody should teach this way. But so therefore, you have asked an extremely powerful question, so I gave you a long answer. But this is my feeling.
I was really struck by something that was said in the film. They said violence as a cleansing force that frees from inferiority. There's this sort of dichotomy between violence as necessary and trying to refrain from violence. And I know you briefly touched on trying not to use violence as a means of liberation. But in terms of especially liberation in sort of the Western Hemisphere, how does that play a role? Because I know, especially in the Caribbean, much of liberation was worn through violence. And again, that sense of it now not only leading towards liberation, but also building up people in a very primitive way. It takes away a lot of the white supremacist lens of education and other things. What are sort of your thoughts on that?
This is a very important moment in the film. And you know what, the word that is used there is on the individual level. Mm-hmm. If you go back to the film, you'll see. So therefore, what Fanon is thinking about, and as I said, it cannot ever happen. But it is impossible but necessary to keep working for it. That there will be no need for violence to give me a sense of to cut through my sense of inferiority. See, Fanon is a baseline healer critic of the disease produced by the fact that colonialism does not respond to you as a human being. So therefore, violence is generated, and it gives you a sense, individual level, it gives you a sense of, So he actually, what we have to understand is that his life's work is to see that it not be needed. So he's at the same time understanding where it comes from. Mm-hmm. He's not saying the colonized are naturally violent.
Right.
And he is at the same time trying to expand psychiatry in terms of diseases produced by colonialism collectively and individually and class-wise. Mm-hmm. Remember, when he talks about the intellectual, he says that the intellectual in Algeria is seeing this side and that side, this side and that side. See, he generally can't make up his mind. Very different from the ones who are gaining superiority from violence, etc. So in for him, there are different kinds of colonial subjects. So I would say that this is where I would go, that he's that business about feeling. And in the Caribbean also, if you look at, I mean, places like Guadeloupe, which is, of course, Marie Condé, Martinique, and Haiti, and the Dominican Republic, etc., you will see that one can follow the track of violence. I mean, think of what happened in Haiti. The Toussaint Louverture was much more of an Enlightenment character than was Napoleon. And so Haiti was therefore, the Black Jacobins were punished. They were punished so that that incredible kind of weight of money produced natural, greedy stuff also within Haiti. We cannot distinguish, if they distinguish and say the colonized are evil, we cannot say the colonizers are all evil. Went to it, I'm talking about the caste system. And in all of the countries that we study through Radiating Globality, what do we see? That the old structures of corruption have come back in globality. And who tells us this? I'm very engaged in Africa-led movements in Africa. And it's, I will name his name, Aloysius Denkabe. He told me when we worked together on the development lobby, and he said to me, he said, Gayatri, don't say class, say power, because our stuff before colonialism that's coming back now, it's power. So that, you know, what's happening in Mozambique today, the chiefs have been brought back in the north, so that it's a very complicated situation in terms of what you're asking, you know, the violence that gives one a sense of superiority. So anyway, I'll stop there with this one.
I want to thank you for coming tonight and speaking with us. I appreciate your presence. So, and I have a question, I have many questions, but I want to maybe ask one question on behalf of my students. I teach in a decidedly non-elite educational space, and we are, we're just recently reading some of Fanon's texts, and I sense on their first encounter some of my students being very impatient with Fanon's discussion on gender and sexuality. And I wonder if you could just, I know it's a little bit, at some level it's of course very related to a discussion we're having tonight, but it might on first instance seem a little bit afield, but I wonder if you can help me help them think about what more has to be said beyond Fanon.
I don't know how you can help them, because I have a sense that in order to be able to teach, you really have to know the people you are dealing with, because I teach totally at the top and also totally at the bottom. I really have to have a sense of the folks I'm dealing with, right? So I can't tell you what you can do with your students, but I can just tell you what I think. See, I would like to make a distinction between consciousness raising, awareness, all that stuff, and ideological production, brainwashing. No, mind-fucking, sorry. Ideological production is mind-fucking. The other one is brainwashing, right? So there, this consciousness raising is, of course, a very American idea, which, remember, I became a tenure-track assistant professor in the fall of 1965, okay? So right in the middle of the 60s and consciousness being raised and teachings and all that stuff. So now, consciousness raising does not, in fact, do anything for ideological production. So, and I always offer the same example because it's a funny example. I know very well, my consciousness is completely raised about the fact that to be married is to introduce the public sphere into private life. It's for legitimation and passage of property. And although the model is taken all across the trans community to, for some kind of gesture of commitment, etc., it is basically a lousy thing. I know that. Okay, that's my consciousness, fully raised. I've been married 3 times. That's my ideological production. And I would probably marry again if I found a liberal billionaire who thinks a trophy wife is not a youthful creature, but an old intellectual. You see what I mean? So that's how consciousness raising and ideological production are different, okay? So therefore, Fanon wanted very much to respect the Algerian woman, understand the veil. He was not someone who was just, I mean, he said some pretty awful things in Black Skin, White Masks about women, etc. So you see, that's the difference, however. He really was a good guy, wanted to, and you know, a psychiatrist can't be unaware of gender difference. But in his own behavior and life, he was, in fact, how would I put it? I mean, you know, bad sexual politics. Well, you know, like Du Bois. It's, you can't do anything about this unless you're honest about these things. So, and others I could name that people would kill me, so therefore I'm not naming them. But so the thing is, if you can make these your students understand that you don't just judge people, you try to understand where they're coming from, what sort of social background. And you know, and there's another story that can be told, which is the story that we used to hear in the 60s about a man in the south side of Chicago who was in fact very much, a bit like my brother, very much, I mean, he fancied himself as like a supporter of women and so on and so forth. And so 4 of them, you know, the 2 men with their wives are sitting in this little bar eating, and then one of the guys uses language, you know, bad language. So, you know, so this guy says, hey, don't use language, there are cunts present. Okay? Now he's actually supporting the women, but he uses that word, right? So these funny examples of me and my marriages and brainwashing and ideological production, or this guy saying there are cunts present, these examples can be used perhaps to tell your students that they have to understand that this is a man who, against, you know, he's a good-looking guy, old Fanon. If you look at the photographs, etc., that are available, he was like, and the way he dresses on the thing, on the beach, and so on and so forth. You know, he, so therefore, this is, you have to understand that he is at the same time also trying to understand something that is completely against the Martinican French gentleman's idea, that is to say, the veiled Muslim woman, he is really trying to understand. And he also acknowledges that the Algerian Revolution, women in fact did, I mean, it's in the book. So therefore, pull them in by showing, I don't know your students, so I don't know if it'll work. I would probably kind of try to see what they're saying, etc. But, as I was saying to Eduardo, you get your imperatives from the persons rather than from me. But on the other hand, that's how I would go about it. Thanks for your question.
Lauren Hill was talking about how the European models of government and society just don't really work. And she was saying when colonies in a new country trying to follow European models, they become like monsters of a nation, and she uses the United States as an example. So how do you think post-colonized countries, especially in Africa, could go about building new methods of running countries that are void of a concrete European model without being considered third world or illegitimate by world powers that are run by European models and organizations like the UN? And is that possible, do you think? And if it is, like, what do you think would be different ways and methods of doing that?
The first of all, I should say that Lauryn Hill is not saying anything.
Yeah.
Those are quotes from Fanon. She's reading. Okay, so, and I believe the quotes were ill-judged, as I have made clear. It's only the ones where, you know, he's putting in all of this stuff. Now, I obviously do not know the answer to your question, because there are 54 countries in Africa, formerly colonized by various different imperial powers, and also South Africa remains a white country, and North Africa thinks of itself as a Mediterranean country, looking that away. So, therefore, it's someone like me, who's just a literature teacher, can't tell you how they can do this and that. But I mean, given the fact that I have been working for a very long time in Senegal, Nigeria, and Ghana, and a little bit in Kenya, I can say that in my own understanding, as I say, those things where Fanon is getting rhapsodic and saying, no more Europe, etc., have to be balanced against, and we have to remember that this is a very young man who knows he's going to die, and he wrote the damn thing in 10 weeks, and so therefore there are passages in there which are this kind of lyrical perorations. And I really do feel that we should read a good deal of Fanon, not just this book, to see how he really thinks and writes all along the way, and also the Mujahid, the thing. But what I would say for myself is that rather than wait to find, in Mozambique, if you want to see, you can take a look at this book, and it's by Juan Obario, The Spirit of the Law in Laws in Mozambique. You can see what's happening with the so-called customary stuff being introduced. What I say is that rather than wait to be non-European, even as we are wearing suits and sitting in chairs and so on and so forth, Chinua Achebe, when he said that, look, we didn't invent the telephone, but we can use it, and not every European invented the telephone. The one guy. So therefore, my feeling as an ex-colonial is that you use what they produced because they were really keeping us down. That this I do believe. I mean, although they were also, I went to a missionary school, not a convent school, missionary school. My teachers were Aboriginals and lower caste Indians whom we had treated like animals, who were Christianized by the missionaries. My parents were smart enough to send me to such a school. The school was an unbelievable experience for upper caste Hindus to be taught. Mm-hmm. I mean, they taught like their entire lives depended on teaching. And did they ever teach us? So to an extent, my own feeling, so I can't just point fingers like that. It's not right. It's not correct. So what I would say is that since they had the time to develop certain kinds of methods, etc., long time, I wish I could tell you about Kathleen Collins's book, but we don't have time. So we always have to vacate rooms. This is also a very funny thing, you know? Heavy-duty things, but vacate rooms. But at any rate, so the what we do is we take this stuff that they developed, because they had a long time from the beginning of capitalism, slow development of industrial capitalism, whereas we now, tarak, no time, digital, immediate, etc. We take the things that they developed. We do not excuse them. We do not accuse them. We find where within the system there is, we know them very well. we find a moment within it where we can stand and turn it around against its own purposes and use them. I call it affirmative sabotage, and it can be done. It can be done, whereas we will be non-European, even as, yeah. I mean, that's bad faith, because everything we are using is, unless you're kind of dressing up to be nice. And remember, the ones who are absolutely at the bottom, if I were working in a 7-Eleven, I wouldn't be able to wear these clothes, by the way. So who are at the bottom, they don't, in fact, dress up to show how cultural they are. They may dress in a different way, but that's not because they're making a cultural statement. I'm also not making a cultural statement. Nobody knows anything about fashion here. I don't follow fashion. So therefore, I would say that is my feeling about what one does with Europe. Thank you for your question.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you.